It began 2 hours and 4 minutes ago. What was 2 hours and 4 minutes ago? Last Christmas Day. That was 2 hours and 4 minutes ago. That's what it feels like, at least. And I don't think it's because I'm tired and getting older that it feels like 2 hours and 4 minutes ago. You feel the same way. The last thing that you cognitively remember was sitting in a hammock on July 4th to take a nap, and then you woke up now. Here, right in this place. You didn't even want to go to church, but somehow you're here now. That's the way that a year passes. And at the end of the year, you always look back and you think about the year. And so I spent some time thinking about 2016, and I lived it up in 2016. I played really hard with my family. We hiked on mountain trails and jumped in freezing cold mountain streams. We went to the beach and we built sandcastles. We swam. I couldn't have dunked or played with or chased or tortured my kids through tickle any more than I did this year. I ate well. I drank well. I slept once. It was a pretty good year all in all as I look back. And then yet I look at 2016 and it was also a pretty painful year. For the first time that I can remember, stress affected me physically. That's never been the case before. I dug in some extended family relationships and realized there's a lot of challenge there and difficulty there. And I'm dealing with right now some agonizing things, not in my life or my immediate family, but in this larger family vintage, this sweet family. It just always comes in waves. Where a person's life, a family seems to be going well. And then with a single text, a single knock at the door, all of a sudden, everything is different for the rest of their lives. It's not like the trauma of losing a job. It's been deeper things where relationship is gone. A child is just gone instantly. And to think through that and to look into their eyes and to feel that pain, it's been a really challenging year. And you can identify with these stories pretty quickly. These are the stories of your year as well. For some of you, 2016 was really fun. You'll look back and you'll think God was sweet that year. It was a really intense time where it was busy, but it was good. And yet others of you will think back and want the ticker for this year to clock down and be done, never remembering what happened, hoping to just put that into a distant place, right? And so when you talk about Advent, it's a difficult thing because no matter where you are, it seems like any words that could be spoken are too shallow. If you had a really good year and you're looking at the last 2.5 weeks and you're ramping up, your expectations are sky high. And I found whenever expectations are sky high, you almost never reach them. And so there's potential that the last 2.5 weeks just kind of drizzle out and it leaves you in a place that you're not expecting. And then yet some of you have, you've suffered this year. And Advent just amplifies your suffering. It's like a bad singer. Picture me. I'm a terrible singer. What would be terrible right now if I started singing a song to you? You would cover your ears and pray for it to be over soon. The only thing worse is if I had a microphone and it was amplified. Then you would leave physically, right? That's amplification, and that's what Advent does to a year of agony or a year of difficulty. If you lost a job, Advent just amplifies the pain. You don't have money to take care of your family, much less splurge for Christmas. If you have a marriage that's failed, the difficulty is amplified all the more. You question if you made the right decision. You look back and you feel lost. If you lost a child, it's just the grieving is just all that much more in this moment, and it's difficult. I want you to know I see you. I'm here with you. I know how you're suffering. We want to be with you. You don't have to come here and pretend. If you're in a really good place right now, be joyful. We need to see your joy. If you're in a really tough place right now, you can suffer with us. You can be angry here. You can not put on a church facade where you have to clean everything up and pretend like it was a nice year. You can just be a mess. It's why I don't want to come and give you messages of fake joy. I don't want to try to propagate some idea of light that scatters darkness. And I certainly don't want to give you a peaceless peace. And so I always feel at Advent, when I'm preparing the messages, there's a difficulty here, and my words are going to be too shallow, and they will be too shallow. And yet the Old Testament says this, that deep calls out to deep. The depth of Jesus can call out to the depth of where you find yourself right now. If you're really full of joy, the depth of the joy of Jesus can just make that all the more rich. And if you're really in a time of agony, the depth of Jesus is enough to meet you right where you find yourself. And so I prayed a lot this week for you. And I know that our primary hope is in prayer. I was in a coffee shop one day this week, and I was thinking about Durham and Midtown, and I was thinking about downtown, and I just started praying for you, the people that I love. I asked the Lord in that moment, would you somehow, in the most normal places of these people's lives, and in secular settings, in their business, in their PTA meetings, in their neighborhoods, would you just rush their lives with the love of Jesus? Would you somehow meet them wherever they are and speak to them? They're going to be okay. Soon you're going to be in the presence of Jesus, actually with him, looking him in the eyes, and love will be crystal clear and doubt will be scattered. But Lord, until that moment, would you give them a sense because of the presence of the Spirit that you are there with them? Do that, Lord. And I want you to know that even as I speak these words and you sit here and you listen, I'm constantly in prayer for you. I'm praising Jesus and asking him to join us in this place that those of you whose relationships are in disrepair or just destitute, that Jesus would somehow surprise you with the richness of his healing. And for you that have been bent by disease and racked by cancer, that the Spirit would give you hope and joy, that wherever you find yourselves, that because the Spirit has joined us here, you know him, right? And so I am so excited this morning to talk to you about joy. And I'm excited to talk to you about joy because joy is incarnated. What that means is joy became flesh and blood. It lived. Joy died. The impossible happened. Joy was resurrected because joy is the Son and joy is the Father and joy is the Spirit. The Son died, but the Father and the Spirit didn't. They resurrected joy from the dead. And so joy is here present in this place right now, and you can have it. It's really good news. You see, joy is not some concept that you need to learn. If joy was a concept that you had to learn, those of you who are predisposed to learning more quickly and deeply would have more joy. And then God would be partial. He would be partial to those who have more capacity to learn. And so joy is not something that you learn. And joy is not a condition that you achieve. If it was a condition that you achieve, then some of us would find happiness right now. Because you've had a child that's healthy, you have a job that pays well, you have fulfillment that you think God is doing in your life, what's supposed to happen. And because the right conditions for joy to exist are there, you'd be full of joy. But then God wouldn't just be partial, he'd be conditional. That promises of God like joy, he promises to you as a fruit of the Spirit, would be void from your life. Because you lost a child this year, you're infertile, you're lonely, you've lost income, and so there's no happiness, there's no fulfillment, but thankfully, joy is not some condition to just walk in. Joy is Jesus. It's far greater than anything you've ever imagined. Now, because this is such a deep concept, God took literally centuries to develop it so the people would be ready. Advent is about the preparation of people for the coming of the gift. And Isaiah chapter 9 speaks about this coming gift, and it says this in chapter 9, verse 3. This is how God works joy into our lives. It says, "You have multiplied the nation. You have increased its joy. They rejoice before you, as with joy at the harvest, as they are glad when they divide the spoil." Now, the first thing that leaps off the pages here is you. And the you in this passage is not you. The you in this passage is God. God multiplied the nation. God did it. God increases the joy. He alone is the one with the capacity to do that thing. Now, here's our hope advantage. When we meet for Sunday gatherings, when we meet in community groups all over the triangle, when we write stuff, when we meet one-on-one, 90% of our conversation, we hope and pray, is about the greatness of God. Is about the beauty of Jesus. And the remaining 10% is because God is so great and he's changed us, now we respond this way. Right? So it's never go achieve this. It's never do this. It's never earn this. It's always Jesus is beautiful. And Jesus raised from the dead, and Jesus is loving, and Jesus is forgiving. Because Jesus is great, you're different. Now live different. That's our hope. And so Isaiah 9:3, you being God, God did all this. Watch what God does. This is how joy starts to stick in your life. You have multiplied the nation. So what this means, God brings more joy with more people in your life. Really? Because look, what I've learned is people like me are a hot mess. Just messy, messy, messy. So it seems like the more people would be, the more mess. Doesn't that seem to be the case? If you're looking for the perfect church that's not a mess, if you're looking for a friend group who's not a disaster, if you're looking for a job, a company that's got it all together, don't go, it's a cult. Okay? Because wherever you find lots of people, you find lots of mess, but God has this way with people, there's just great joy. Think about it. With more people, there's more laughter. If you're alone, you can make yourself chuckle just a little bit. You can't like laugh a lot. It's just one. It's one chuckle. It's a chuck. It's just a little thing, right? It's not a whole lot. You don't get this belly aching laugh. You just laugh a little bit. But with more people, you can't breathe because you're laughing so hard. They're just adding to the laughter and the humor, and there's more joy with more people. When you hurt, the same thing is true. If you're deeply hurting, you don't want to be alone. If you hit your thumb with a hammer, you want to be alone for a minute. But if you have experienced the loss of a loved one, nobody wants to be alone in that. Because with people, there's comfort. And when the Lord comforts us, he can restore joy. Think about the holidays. Every picture that you have about the holidays involves people. It doesn't really make sense. When people come into your house, they eat all your food. You wanted chips and salsa, and it's gone. You think you would be mad. The more people, the more it starts to smell bad. For some reason, it smells like fish, and it shouldn't, but get a lot of people in there. Just like this is sourness of the smell. But every single picture that you have about the holidays is more people. And when they're gone, you're sad. Right? We've bought into this myth in the United States that we're independent. We're independent people, which is a myth. We're actually very dependent. If you had lived in a different time period where groups kind of huddled together in smaller numbers, you would realize your dependency on other people. There goes the only woman who can heal. If you get sick, you better be in right relationship with her. There goes the family that farms. They're the only people that provide for food. There goes the people that sew clothes. We better make sure that we're not naked in the winter. We should have a good relationship with that person. Right? But we live in a society where we think we're independent, but really there's this tying together where our lives are totally dependent. You don't make your own clothes. You don't make your own medicine. You don't make your own food. And so the more people involved in your life, the more joy there is on every single level. God brings joy by multiplying the nation, by multiplying his people. And then he says, you have increased joy. God is increasing it. And I think that's really interesting if you dig in it just a little bit. God has given us all things, and he said that it's for our enjoyment and all things are good. But most things that are good can be used to the excess and become bad. Food is good. Too much food becomes very destructive. But work is really good. The work ethic in the Bible is 6 days a week. It's higher than our work ethic. And work is good, but too much work, you start to lose relationship and you lose lots of things that are important, like health. Too much rest makes you apathetic and lethargic. And so most things, as it increases, hits this point where too much is bad. But a few things, the more it increases, the better it is. Love is sweet. The more love you have, it's just all that much sweeter. Purity is freedom. If you don't know that, let's talk. The more pure something is, the more freedom you have, the more wealth that you have, not financial wealth, but just core goodness. And joy is one of those things. The more joy you have, the more it increases, the better your life becomes. And when this joy increases and increases, it says in this passage, they rejoice before you as with joy at the harvest. Now for us, the harvest is every single day of our lives. You can walk into Food Lion or Harris Teeter and the harvest is absolutely everywhere. You have not gone 8 months without vegetables unless you intended to, and that's why you're so greasy, right? There's just vegetables all year round. You have not had to eat jerky as your primary protein for 6 months, but that is the history of the world. You would smoke meat to a place where it was just rawhide, and you would chew on it for months. That's how you had sustenance. You've never once had to pile the remaining food that you have, hoping that you make it to harvest. And each little pile represents a day. And you know that there's not enough calories in each pile to keep you alive for very long, but if you don't stretch it, you won't make it. And so each pile represents scarcity. You're barely making it. And the thing about the harvest is that you had no capacity to change when it arrived. You couldn't make winter pass any more quickly. You couldn't protect the crop from oncoming storms. You just had to wait. And that waiting built this expectancy and this longing and this desire for change to happen. And then all of a sudden, the harvest is ready. And you can pull it in. And then you go from nothing, scarcity, to not just plenty, but excess. You've eaten your full, your stomach is just bulging, and there's food everywhere, and fine wine is running down your chin because it doesn't matter if you waste it. You just have vats of it full, and there's music, and there's people, and you're celebrating. You rejoice when God brings the harvest in. And then this last little piece here is they rejoice before you as they are glad when they divide the spoil, the spoils of war, meaning you have gold that you didn't purify, you have silver that you did not pound, you have diamonds that you did not mine, you have been given something and you didn't earn it. Warriors went out, took it, brought it back, and just gave it to you, and you're dividing up the spoils of joy, and you had nothing to do with it. You didn't earn it at all, right? So God brings joy through increase in people, and it's unearned. Now, our hope for Advent is to take Isaiah 9 and show you its fulfillment in the New Testament. That it's not a condition that you try to achieve, it's a person. And so every week we're spending 15 minutes in Isaiah 9 and then the last portion in the New Testament showing you how these things are incarnated, flesh and blood. So I want to show you how Jesus is joy. One of the best places to do that is Mark chapter 10, verses 46 through 52. Just listen to these words. Let me read them to you. And they came to Jericho, and as he was leaving Jericho with his disciples and a great crowd, Bartimaeus, a blind beggar, the son of Timaeus, was sitting by the roadside. And when he heard that it was Jesus of Nazareth, he began to cry out and say, "Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me." And many rebuked him, telling him to be silent. But he cried out all the more, "Son of David, have mercy on me." And Jesus stopped and said, "Call him." And they called the blind man, saying, "Take heart, get up, he is calling you." And throwing off his cloak, he sprang up and came to Jesus. And Jesus said to him, "What do you want me to do for you?" And the blind man said to him, "Rabbi, let me recover my sight." And Jesus said to him, "Go your way, your faith has made you well." And immediately he recovered his sight and followed him on the way. Consider the statistical impossibility of this story. There's a man born blind, and all of his life, the only thing that he can do is beg. And then, for some reason, God decides to incarnate himself, become a human being. And this human being named Jesus, who's God-man, lives pretty close to Bartimaeus. And for 30 years, kind of builds some stuff and makes houses. And then all of a sudden decides to start a ministry to care for people. And his ministry includes miraculously healing people. And as a beggar, a blind man, you're starting to think inside yourself, it's too good to be true, but maybe this God-man named Jesus will come near me and heal me. But still, it's a distant probability. And then Jesus starts to travel around. He's not just healing people near him, but he's traveling to different parts of the countryside. And rumor has it that as he's going along, he's healing more and more people, but it's still a few considering the masses. And then the word comes that he's going to come to your city. And you have a little hope, but it's still distant because it's a big city and Jesus is just one person. So you try to position yourself and you try to ready yourself that maybe you can be just the lucky one in the right place. And then, far beyond any hope, Jesus comes into the earshot of you sitting on the ground, and you start yelling his name out. And that God-man who has started miraculously healing people walks up to you, and because you have a single shred of faith, really is just begging, this God-man decides to have mercy on you, and your fate is changed. If you think this is a statistical impossibility, I'd like to humbly suggest you have a very reductionistic depiction of the power and the presence of God. We have, unfortunately, mixed a pseudo-Christianity with a concept of fate, that one person is going to become the luckiest of the lucky because they were just with, you know, pure luck, sitting in the right place at the right time, and Jesus stumbled along. They kind of won the Powerball, and Jesus is the dealer of the Powerball. No, it's not like that. That's not the story that's here. Jesus is not dealing out lucky fate. He is joy incarnate. What this passage says is that darkness had come down over you. You were unlucky. Fate had looked badly upon you. And then the sun starts to rise. And at first, it's just a single beam of light. And that beam of light is captivating to you. There was just abject darkness everywhere. You were meandering and stumbling. And then one beam of light, you're transfixed on it. It's beyond anything that you'd ever seen before. And then you realize it's not a single beam of light, but it's the rising of the sun. And when the sun has risen, the darkness is gone. That's what's happening in this passage. That is Jesus rising, and wherever he rises, all who see it can be changed. That's not a statistical impossibility. Right? This passage says the harvest is about to come. And in this harvest, you had nothing to do with it. You didn't have any seeds of joy to plant. You didn't have a crop that you tilled and worked hard on and made grow. No, no. What happened is you were blind, and this God-man named Jesus walked into your blindness, and he planted seeds of joy. And he made the seeds of joy grow, and the harvest arrived. Jesus is the harvest, and you have Jesus. That is not hard. That's not statistically improbable. It's the easiest thing ever. Jesus is here, and you can have him. Jesus is here, and more importantly, he wants your blindness. Jesus wants your depression. Jesus wants the abuse that's been done to you. Jesus wants the moment that you were raped. Jesus wants the moment that you tried to commit suicide and didn't work. Jesus wants the grief of the loss of your child. Jesus wants the humiliation that you felt when your spouse left you. Jesus wants the fear that your child is sick and you can't do anything about it. Jesus wants your overwhelmingly debilitating thought that you were in control and you lost your job and now you have nothing. Jesus wants your blindness. And he has come to give you joy, and with the rising of the sun, the blindness is gone. This is not statistically impossible. It's for everyone who chooses to hear Jesus and see that he wants your blindness. But often we get stuck in this quasi-Christianity that believes in fate. You think your fate is to be blind. You think your fate is to be depressed. You think your fate is to be dead spiritually. And some of these things won't be changed until you get into the presence of Jesus, but he is actively undoing all these things. And so the message of Bartimaeus is, if you want joy, go get it. Get up and get it. Bartimaeus is unbelievably persistent. He refuses not to have joy. And if that seems too great to you, or it still seems impossible, joy here in this passage is unearned. Bartimaeus just had to have it. And he had to have it maybe because he suffered more than you have suffered or I have suffered. His whole life was sitting outside of the gate of the city in the heat of the summer and the cold of the winter begging. That man knew suffering. And when he thought joy had come close, there was nothing that was going to keep him from joy. And so as he yells out, Jesus, do you know what other people say? Shh, shut it. Don't call him. He's too busy for you. You're not important. He doesn't care for you. Somehow Bartimaeus had become a nuisance. And if you're honest, people in need, they kind of become nuisances. I mean, I know I'm not supposed to say that, but that's true. Like my kids. You can laugh. It's true. My kids are a nuisance sometimes. They're always in need. They start asking questions at 5 a.m. Hey, are you awake? To which the godly response is, run, little child. Right? That's how you respond. But because they have so many needs in their life, they just ask questions constantly. And when you have three kids, and a couple of years ago, this story happened, and so they were all under eight, and they all have lots of needs, and they just question. And by like 7:45, you've had it, and you start to make decrees, no more questions for 45 minutes. And my boy at this time was 3 and a half, and he goes, but Dad, which is a question. And I just lost it because he's being such a nuisance. And I was like, Lincoln, don't talk. And I wasn't even looking at him. I was over here cooking breakfast, trying to feed the kid because he's needy and he's asked for food. And then I hear this little whimper coming from the other room. I'm like, oh, what's going on? And I look up, and he had climbed at 3 years old the outside of the steps and was like 9 feet up, and he's hanging onto the bars, and his little lip is, and he's crying because he can't ask for help. I've just shouted at this kid who's about to die, and I've told him, just, who does that? Like, what kind of dad does that? But that's what happens when you're a nuisance. And Bartimaeus was absolutely a nuisance. Who could blame him, though? He's hungry, and he doesn't know where to sleep, and he doesn't have the capacity to find a way to clean himself. Just basic human needs. And so when he sees Jesus, he yells out, and the crowd gets mad because you shouldn't bother Jesus. You don't have anything to barter with. You don't have anything to trade. You can't buy Jesus's time. So just keep quiet over there. And yet something wild happens. What does Bartimaeus do to earn joy? Not one single thing. Not one single thing. He just asks for it. That's all he does. Jesus, I'm really tired of begging. I need joy. And in the asking, there's this unbelievable faith. In asking, it shows that Jesus has become his only hope. Now, don't get this confused, right? I'm not saying that he doesn't have any doubt. I'm not saying that intellectually he's arrived at a place where all of his questions have been answered. If you're waiting for all of your intellectual questions to be answered before you follow Jesus, you'll never follow Jesus. But if you come to a place where you realize that your only hope is Jesus, you'll go to Jesus no matter what. He realizes Jesus is his only hope. He also realizes that Jesus is his only option. He's tried everything. He's tried different medical procedures. He's tried religious ceremonies. He's bartered. He's bought. He's paid. And he's just in a place where he doesn't have anything else to barter or to pay with. And so when you don't have anything to barter, you're out of options and you just yell out for mercy. Give me mercy. I need that. It's interesting. Historically, the places that Christianity thrives the most are with the people in the most need. It's thriving right now in South America in slums of massive cities. It's thriving in the ghettos of Africa. It's blowing up in brothels of Southeast Asia. These men and women are in desperate need, and they have nothing to barter, and so they beg for Jesus, and Jesus comes close. Too many of us this morning are bartering with Jesus. You're bartering with good deeds, and you're bartering with finances, and you're bartering with intellectualism, or you've just given up on Jesus totally. There is no such thing as God because you're smart enough and you're wealthy enough to walk away from him, not knowing you're in desperate need and you're blind. You can't barter, you just ask. And when you ask for joy because you can't earn it, it's a free gift. He just gives it to you. It's a lot like children on Christmas Day. Let me tell you about my children on Christmas Day. They wake up at 8 a.m., 9 a.m., you know, just kind of leisurely. They take showers and wash their hair and dry their hair. They get in their Sunday best. They begin to write out plans of how they're going to repay every penny for each present that they receive. And then when we wake up at 9 or something like that, we walk out and they tell us their plan. We're going to rake leaves before we open the presents. And then we're going to have a hot chocolate stand because it's winter and you can't have a lemonade stand. And we'll sell hot chocolate. And when we have every penny, we'll then pay for our presents and then we'll open them. Does that sound good, father and mother? They kick the door down at 5:30 and they say, give me my presents now. And do you know what we do? while we make them take one picture on the steps, which is torture and eternity for them. But then we let them open all their presents and it's great joy. Go to the Father, ask for joy like a child on Christmas morning, and he gives it to you even though you haven't earned it. And when he gives it to you like this, joy just ever increases. So think about Bartimaeus here just for a moment. He had never seen anything at all. And then all of a sudden he can see. And the more he sees, the more joy he has, right? He had never seen a hamburger before. Joy's coming. He had never seen a woman before. And he sees a woman in the glory of what God did and joy comes. The first day passes, the sun sets, and he looks at the sunset and he's just angry at people. Why didn't you tell me it looked like this? That's amazing. And then he turns over and do you know what happens? He looks into the eyes of God. Jesus is there. It says in the end of the passage, he's following Jesus. Family, that's joy. When you look into the eyes of Jesus, and one day soon you will look into the eyes of Jesus. And so you might be agonizing right now. You might be suffering now, but soon joy will increase for the rest of eternity. So here's how I send you out and conclude. God brings joy like the harvest. It increases and you can't earn it. And you, the people of God, are supposed to be the ones who increase joy in the world that we live in. You're supposed to be joy. The more people, the more joy. Right? Everywhere Jesus goes, there's a crowd of people. And I love that. He leaves one city, and because he did so much and taught so much in that city, they leave their jobs and they follow Jesus. And then as he's going to another city, people have heard about the coming of Jesus in that city and said they're coming out. And so Jesus is constantly stuck in the wilderness. Do you wonder why he's always stuck in the wilderness? It's this conversion of mass, this mass of people. There's just people everywhere. And as you sit down and you look around the people, you say, hey, that was the little girl that was dead. And Jesus spoke into her life and she walks. That was the woman who was ostracized and marginalized because she was bleeding for over a decade and now she's whole and healed. That's Lazarus. He was dead, but now he walks. Those people over there, they're part of the 5,000 who ate the food that Jesus miraculously produced. There's just these stories of joy everywhere. And now you're the people of God who have stories of joy and you're supposed to increase joy everywhere you go. When you meet in community, you're supposed to say, hey, there goes the woman who had brain cancer. She should be dead, but she walks. There goes the couple who is devastated by adultery and an affair, but God did something beautiful and their marriage is richer now. That's unbelievable forgiveness. There goes a single man or a woman who has been single all their life that you would think is lonely and doesn't have family, but this is their family and they have great joy. There goes the people that doubt, but Jesus did them like Thomas and showed them the wounds and the people of God demonstrated the greatness of Jesus. And so you're the joy of Jesus. You're the incarnation of Jesus in this place, in the city that we live in. Go be the joy. Joy actually lived. Joy actually died. Joy resurrected, and joy is here for you now. And any who ask for it will receive it. Jesus is joy. Let's pray. God, we ask that just real simple, that would happen in this place right now. The incarnation of joy, Jesus, the Son of God, would enter into this room and the presence of the Spirit would be so rich and full, you would change us, Lord, that we would become the toughest lot of human beings ever to live, impossible to be offended, impossible to be overwhelmed, broken but not defeated, crushed but not obliterated, full of hope, full of mercy, full of Jesus. And we would be honest with each other when we suffer, we're enough for each other. When we're beaten down, we care for each other. When we're full of joy, we share it with each other. And that, Lord, these people would continue the incarnation of joy, for joy is alive, and we get to be the ones that bear them. We love you, Jesus, and we ask these things in your name. Amen.